Today we're on the non-sport side of the ledger with James Coulter, who close friend to and confidant to Princess Diana. James, tell us about what was it that was so special about Diana that caught the imagination of Britain and really the entire world?
Well, she was a great enthusiast, Nick. She was very close. She had a very clever way of getting to be in touch with people. She was a very warm person. And I think a bit that didn't always come across was a great wicked sense of humour. She was full of mischief, and it was great fun then trying to get that spirit to grow. I mean, she had no real guidance at the time she joined the royal family, well entrenched, you know, existing traditions, very strong. And here was a very free spirit wanting to express and perhaps exemplify a kind of growth in a new way. And I remember watching the kind of suppression that she felt at the beginning before she really got in touch with her ability to express stuff well. And the frustrations at various lunches I had with her then. And then one day she handed me a speech that she was meant to be delivering to a charity about 4 days later and said, you know, what do you think of this? Because they'd been written by the charity, of course. And I didn't feel it was in her spirit. I didn't think it was expressing her enough. So I told her, like an idiot, that I didn't think the speech was up to her, really. I thought she was better than that. And she said, right, then you do one. You write the speech. So I sat down, we wrote the speech, and trying to get her kind of spirit into it. And things really took off from there, and she suddenly felt able to express herself, and we had huge fun. I remember writing about 9 speeches in all. Exhausting process for me, but nonetheless great fun.
And you were an anonymous speechwriter, really, for most of that, right?
Well, the value of the whole thing was to be hidden in the background so that people would realize it was, as it were, her input. And then, to be fair, we did sit down and we laughed about some ideas and so on, and then it was my task to try and get it on paper and to run it through the various soundbite stages to make sure it didn't say anything offensive to anybody, and tried to get some messages across to people that were helpful.
Well, that wedding, of course, Charles was 32, the Prince of Wales, Diana was 19, and so this was a story of her, and is a story of her growing into womanhood and into a sense of her own power as well. So initially, Charles began to notice that she was getting as much or indeed more attention than he was, and then compounding this, as I read and see the story unfold, is her finding a sense of her own intellectual power as well. What happened, do you think, with Charles and their relationship?
Well, I think one of the things that happened is that he was on a very organized side of the family, big support structure. He had a lot of officials working for him, writing stuff for him. I'm afraid to say groveling a lot around him, and so nothing was going to change there. And here was someone in Diana who liked change. She was going to try and challenge some of the existing side. And also, to be fair, Nick, she was a lot better looking than he is. So I think she had that edge, and she was youthful. And also, she was out there very freely and obviously very willingly. She liked being amongst the people. She enjoyed all that side. And I think that was the side that touched people. I think when she went walk about with the AIDS patients, she went walk about at night to see the down and outs in the streets of London. And she did that very quietly. And I think that was that generated an animal that the royal family and the organization around the royal family simply weren't used to.
They weren't used to, and so they reacted as if it was a threat rather than as one more example of a new way for the royal family to re-engage with the population.
Absolutely. And I mean, running through her diary with her from time to time, the workload was unbelievable. You know, she would flip from one engagement to another with about a 2-minute change time. She was doing far too much. And I think that was one of the loads that went. And I think sometimes in the evening when she got back and actually received criticism from the organization that she was essentially representing, I think that was a very tough deal. And I think much of it was based on jealousy in one or two of those who were trying to steer Prince Charles's life, who were gauging success of their job on what press coverage they had. And here was the girl who was wiping their eye, not really setting out to, but ultimately, I think, getting far more coverage in a much newer spirit. And I think, in fact, was a great boon for the monarchy.
We're talking about Princess Diana with James Coulter, longtime friend and confidant who actually first met Diana when she was 16. By the age of 22, 23, did you see a significant change in Diana and her sense of self-confidence?
Well, I think it went downhill, and I think, you know, the early stages of maybe joining a big corporation, which is effectively how it was, you know, it's Monarchy PLC, and it was a big problem, and I think she wasn't really catered for. They didn't realize they had a fairly wild card in their midst, and it took some time for that to happen. So she was given really no assistance much, and I think, you know, inevitably a pretty lonely job, just produce the children and move on, you know, and you'll do what you're told. Well, she wasn't that kind of a person, and anybody who'd seen her before would have known that. And so I think from that moment on, you know, a group of us around it started asking her out to lunch and stuff to try and give her some footholds outside
about
the corporation.
5 years into your marriage?
Yes, about 5 years in. And to try to get these tendrils going. And then various tasks we tried to get involved with in helping with some of the PR elements and just to get that spirit out there. And it was great fun. I remember when she came round to open a new CT scanner at the hospital I was working at the time. She stopped outside one of the lifts where there were some porters. There were a big crowd of people, and one of the porters was chewing gum. You know, this is typical of her kind of sense of humor. And he was very embarrassed when she stopped opposite him as he was chewing the gum. And then, you know, he said, "You're a porter, are you?" And he said, "Yes, yes." "Oh, fine. Well, it's great of you to turn up today." She then went to the next one, who was another porter, and said, "Oh, great to see you here." Then went back to the first guy who was chewing the gum, who thought he'd got away with it, and said, "Is that Wrigley's?" And of course, he was looking for somewhere to put the chewing gum, but he was stuck. And she then went to beyond and came back to him a second time and said, "Is that the green one or the white one?" You know, and then got into the lift and turned to me and said, "Well, I guess they chew it in front of their bosses, don't they?" She knew exactly what she was doing, and in a way, that kind of charm in making a point, but making a point very gently was one of the great attributes she had.
When I think of figures that have impacted us, certainly there is no greater measure than the fact that we remember what we were doing when we learned that they died. And I remember when John F. Kennedy died, I was at a sixth grade party that I was hosting for a friend. I was 6 years old, excuse me. And I remember I was in Florida. And I remember exactly where I was at a restaurant when I heard, and it's so difficult to believe that this had happened, and I think it was certainly shared by millions of people around the world. Let's shift to the darker side of the story, which is what happened after the marriage disintegrated, and what happened surrounding those events that led to her death.
I think one of the difficulties is that she was going through a bad patch, as they say, difficulty finding a new role for herself, and she'd done that really a bit through the landmines. I remember suggesting to her some time before that some link with the Red Cross or something would give her an independent focus, which would then free her to do what she might want to do. And so the landmines was a nice touch, and she felt very moved by the plight she'd seen in people. And I think to choose a really unpopular area was a very courageous move at the time. But at the time around Paris, she looked as though she was stabilizing a bit. There was a relationship, obviously, looking as though it was going somewhere with Dodi Fayed. And I think the big tragedy was that this car accident happened at a time when maybe she was on the climb from the dark times that followed the breakup of the marriage.
Certainly a lot of depression.
Yeah, she'd had a tough time after it. She was having difficulty finding her feet, and I think she'd lost some of the support structure because she'd chosen to that had been around her before that. And I think that one of the great tragedies is that purely as a medic, this was one of the most awful things, because interestingly, the ambulance that was taking her back to the hospital from the car crash stopped at the curb for maybe 40 minutes, only just a few hundred yards short of the hospital.
And, with her in.
With her inside, and it's a complete mystery to me why that happened. And I think
have you ever heard of that in your entire career, with 25 odd years in medicine, have you ever heard of anything like that with someone, not because of their importance, but simply because they are in a life-threatening situation, that you would stop for 40 minutes within eyesight of the hospital?
Well, I've never heard of it, Nick, and in fact the strange thing is that, you know, our experience is the desperation to stabilize as quickly as you can and then foot hard on the floor to get them in the door. The interesting thing is that she had an injury which was quite similar to Ronald Reagan's injury when he was shot, and he survived, you know, and
at the age of 75.
And in my view, the French system should have done better than that. I mean, she had youth on her side, she was pretty fit, and this was a fairly standard deceleration accident. The injury was a fairly classic one from that type of accident, and if she got in the door, because she was said to have lived for another 15 or 25 minutes after she got into the hospital, and that meant on top of the 40 minutes at the curb, they had time. I mean, it would have meant, you know, opening her chest to get the vessels repaired, but this was not unusual. It worked with Reagan, and for a younger patient, it would have been much easier.
Why would they be fleeing a hotel with the retinue, the entourage that she had, with a Mercedes to drive? Why would they be driving off in a dangerous fashion, no matter how many press were trying to follow them?
And Nick, there was absolute hysteria surrounding her, and only a day and a half earlier, she had told some of the press that were around her in the south of France that she had something pretty big to tell. And what that was, of course, remains a mystery to some people, but that really conjured up this frenetic madness. And certainly from my own experience after she died, the press panic was enormous, and they were just like hungry wolves. And I think, to be fair, they were trying to outrun them, but in a way she had, by her announcement, maybe generated the very madness that led to her having to flee it.
And this so-called white Fiat that may have forced their car, some theorize, into this abutment and this tunnel. There was a search. Why was it so difficult to find a white Fiat if you have 25% of the gendarmes in Paris?
Well, it was very strange. I mean, most people expect to find a car very quickly. I mean, the French police state is notorious for its ability to track almost anybody and anything. And the fact that this Fiat wasn't found for a long time was an absolute mystery, unless, of course, an instruction had gone out to say, please don't find it, you know, just make the process look as though it's happening and don't find it. And I think when the journalist who was actually driving that Fiat was found dead, maybe a year and a half later in some woods, that was a very strange set. There's some mystery around this one, and like all good things, one of the reasons that Diana will live on is that she was an enigma, and the part of her death was also an enigma. And I think we await in England to see how the investigation
into her death... What is happening with her now?
Well, there's now an investigation which has been stirred by Dodi Fayed's father, mainly. In England, there's an investigation into the death, because there's a number of unexplained elements to it. And amongst which is that the blood alcohol level, now there is some story that the samples were switched and that it wasn't actually his blood in the tube.
Because it was impossible for him to have it that high and be able to even stand, let alone drive.
Well, actually, Nick, it goes beyond that. Apparently the blood type in that sample wasn't his. So the other thing is that the blood level, the alcohol level in that sample was so high that I think he wouldn't have even been able to get onto the stool, let alone fall off it. You know, he was so... So far, it was such a high level. So.
Well, James Coulter, we'll talk and finish up talking a little bit more about the Fenzian Unit and this team across the country that is developing a scientific foundation. But I hope you'll come back. I hope we'll have you on the show again to talk more about Diana and her memory, and also more about this wonderful new resource for medicine. We'll be right back with James Coulter with final thoughts on Head Games Radio in just a minute. Welcome back to Head Games Radio. We want to thank James Coulter for being on the show today. And also, frankly, you've had some threats. I mean, you were someone who delivered and met with Diana in Kensington Palace, came out on your bicycle. So you've told these stories, and there is some level of threat. Some of the people that got close to Diana met with untimely deaths as well.
They did. I mean, it's a risk of life, and it was always a little bit unclear why some of those departures happened. In particular, you know, Barry Manicky, who was a policeman who was close to her early on. I think that was a hairy thing. She was always worried. She always said, you know, I hate you being on the bicycle because it's so easy to tip you off, you know. Mm-hmm. So my answer was to buy a motorbike. I don't think that made any difference.
No.
But anyway, there it was.
Final information about the Fenzian Unit. Fenzian, FENZIAN.com. Where do you see this going in the next 2, 3, 4 years once you get through that 5 to 7 year trial period the FDA requires?
Well, what's happening is a growing band, and I've been very lucky about those who've wanted, who's volunteered to come and train to be Fenzian practitioners. We've been really lucky. There's now a network growing. And I think as we add modalities, hopefully, to the pain relief side, I think it'll be just another option, which I think patients will be very grateful for.
This is not, by the way, a medical infomercial. This is someone, myself, I can tell you, that my shoulder was in such pain that I could not sleep. I woke up 10 to 30 times a night for 6 to to 8 weeks. And though I've looked at this, and I think you can make up your own mind, but the bottom line is there are resources out there. We've talked about on the show before, of course, oil technologies, and hopefully this country heading towards some solutions that will take us away from a dependence on oil. Well, certainly a dependence on medicine that's always external, that's always based on pharmaceuticals, not based on, you know, some level of control with the patient itself. It would be an incredible contribution to medicine.
And I think one of the joys, sitting here in Phoenix with you, Nick, and the sun out there, we've actually managed to power the unit using a solar panel to recharge the batteries. And I quite like that idea of sunlight into health. You know, that seems to be a good idea. And my aim when I set off on this road was the idea that it would be really great to be able to see people being treated when I'm asleep at bed at night. Somebody using that technology is helping.
Absolutely. Fenzian.com, F-E-N-Z-I-N, Fenzian.com. We also want to thank DrivenDesignSolutions.com. If you're looking for a great website, check out Head Games Radio for the clips. This entire show will be on by tonight. You can listen to it, listen to the story of Diane and the new Fenzian unit. Thanks for listening to Head Games Radio. We'll see you tomorrow. As always, have a great day.